Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, or in the summer a little less frequently, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. Today, I'm joined by Noelani Goodyear Ka'opoa, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. In 1999, she co-founded the Halokumana Public Charter School, where she served as a teacher, administrator, and a board member. It is the remarkable story of this school, the challenges and contradictions they faced, the sovereign indigenous pedagogies they developed, the political revitalization they were born of and fostered, that is the subject of her profound new work, The Seeds We Planted, Portraits of a Native Hawaiian Charter School, just released from the University of Minnesota Press, in conjunction with First Peoples, New Directions in Indigenous Studies. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Noelani, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm honored you could join me today. We're discussing your new book, The Seeds We Planted, Portraits of a Native Hawaiian Charter School. It's just released from the University of Minnesota Press in conjunction with First Peoples, New Directions in Indigenous Studies. One of the reasons I'm excited you're here for this conversation, beyond the fact that it's a quite beautiful book, it's also your intimate connection to the story that you tell eloquently. I think oftentimes on this program, we have really wonderful writers who are nonetheless often very distant from what they're writing about, whether because of a gap of time or geography or culture, but this is really your story. It's the story of your colleagues and students and the struggle for indigenous-centered education in a settler colonial structure. So I'm excited to discuss it. But before we jump into that struggle, I'm hoping you can introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to put this story into a book.
Sure. Well, yes, it's definitely a story that I'm close to, that my family has been close to, and I think Indigenous education in many places has been something that people have seen as, you know, important work that communities and families need to be at the base of. So it makes sense that, you know, you get really interconnected to the work that you're doing. So I am Kanaka Maoli, a Native Hawaiian, and was raised in a school system, actually went to private school here in Hawaii, but both the public and private schools in Hawaii, like in many other settler colonial contexts, really marginalize, if pay any attention at all, to Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous cultural practices and values. And so that was my experience growing up. Like so many people, schooling was a place that really devalued, in many ways, who we are as Indigenous people, and the vast and really, you know, brilliant, knowledges and technologies that our ancestors developed over, hundreds of generations in direct connection with, the lands that are part of who we are. And so, when I was in just coming out of college, actually still in my early 20s, started getting involved in education, and it was something that was a really important thing to me to, you know, continue to raise up new generations of young people. And it actually, one of the kind of stories that I tell right at the beginning of the book is this experience of teaching an applied English class with a group of Hawaiian students that were part of a bridge program between high school and the community college here in the island. And just being very surprised in some ways that none of them had really been exposed to much in terms of Hawaiian literature, either in the Hawaiian language or in English. And these were just brilliant students in so many ways, but they had been really disconnected from this long legacy of Hawaiian, both Hawaiian writing, for one, and then an even longer legacy of Hawaiian knowledge production, you know, and all of the brilliance, as I said, of Kanaka Maoli. And that really impacted the way that they saw themselves as scholars, you know, and writers, or not, more appropriately, that they didn't necessarily see themselves as people who were producers of knowledge, who could be active engager, active in engaging the world in that way. And so we started kind of thinking about, dreaming about what it could be like to create a school. So students weren't just doing this kind of thing, engaging with Hawaiian knowledge in a summer program, but that it was actually the foundation of what they were learning. And it was at a time in Hawaii where there were communities all over the islands who were beginning to do this, and were really being organized by a couple, Ku Kakalau and her husband, Nale Kakalau, and they went throughout the islands and were encouraging people to, you know, take this desire and these visions and to create charter schools. And so that's what happened, basically, in at the turn of the 21st century, this explosion in charter schools that happened across the U.S. In Hawaii, what happened was that the majority, just over half of all the schools that were started by Native communities.
So I want to start by asking a little bit about the history of public education in Hawaii. It's a kind of a surprising story, I think, for people who are used to the narratives of sort of North America around indigenous people and education, where the story is often, at least in terms of formal institutional education, is one of imposition. It's part of the colonial process. But you write that public schools in Hawaii did not always function as part of the settler state. There's a very rich history in the 19th century. I'm hoping you can talk a bit about that. I know it's a big question, but some of that backstory and how the school system ultimately did become folded into the settler colonial project.
Sure. So similarly, I think the narrative in Hawaiian historiography for many years now has been that schooling was simply imposed upon Hawaiians, that it was part of the missionizing and colonizing process, like you mentioned. But really kind of inspired by some of the more recent work over the last 10, 15, 20 years by scholars who have been looking into the huge Hawaiian language archive. So Noi Noi Sova and her book Aloha Betrayed is, you know, one sort of stunning example of that, how when you start to look at Hawaiian voices and this archive of Hawaiian language materials, whether it's government documents or newspapers, that you find a whole different story than if you were just only looking at the records from that were written from an English and colonial point of view. And so with Hawaii, you know, we have a unique history where, beginning in the 1840s, our leaders formalized our government, our centralized government, as a state, as a nation state, and got international recognition from the major powers of the time, and began, you know, establishing all of the sort of hallmark institutions of the modern nation state. But, you know, and this is an independent Hawaii run by Native Hawaiian leaders primarily. And so public schools was a part of that. So the creation of a public school system was under the independent Hawaiian kingdom, under a constitutional monarchy. And the first heads of school were Native Hawaiian scholars. These were scholars who had been educated within seminaries that were set up by Protestant missionaries. But, you know, they had taken this education in their own ways, and many Hawaiians took up the technologies of print literacy and then the whole institution of schooling itself to use for the assertion of our own independence and sovereignty. And so the first school system, public school system in Hawaii, really was Native-led, which is somewhat unique. It, you know, it's not the only situation where this has happened, but it is different than the sort of narrative of schools were just simply imposed and kids were stolen from their families. And, you know, the public schools at that time were in some ways like the sort of charter school model where they're local community run. The boards were comprised of parents and teachers who were part of the schools. And so over the next 50 years, you know, the white planter elite was growing in power, economic power. They were consolidating military power. They were also beginning to make, you know, certain kinds of political ties with the U.S., which was expanding its own empire. And so they began to sort of shift the balance of power over, of control over public education in Hawaii toward the 1870s, 1880s. And then, but up until the, let me just say, but up until the 1893, when the armed invasion by the U.S. takes place in Hawaii, the majority of teachers in the public school system were still Native Hawaiian. And much of the education was still done in the Hawaiian language. So it's really that takeover of power when the U.S. expands its empire into Hawaii and then, of course, other parts of the Pacific after 1898, that there's a complete shift in governance over public education.
Now, it sounds like the present is also very unique in certain ways in Hawaii, just on a larger basis. It's the only state where Indigenous students comprise the largest portion of public school enrollment. You also point out that it's the most centralized system in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could actually clarify what that means, but also in part of that, I'm just kind of curious. You mentioned this a bit at the outset, but what were the conditions within public education in Hawaii that really spurred the growth of your own school and all the Native charter schools?
Sure. Yeah, so Hawaii is part of that the legacy of, you know, the colonial legacy in schooling is that there's a very bifurcated system in Hawaii where the difference between public and private schools is very marked. And that, you know, that's true in many places, but it's especially sort of marked here. So when you look at who goes to school where, you know, as far as people of different ethnic backgrounds or settlers versus Indigenous peoples, you know, that plays out as far as where students are, what the student population is. So within the mainstream Department of Education public school system in Hawaii, our students are Native Hawaiian students make up, as you mentioned, the largest ethnic grouping within the schools, even though as a people we make up about a fifth of the population in Hawaii today. So we're overrepresented as students in that system, but we're underrepresented at the levels of decision making, governance, administration, in positions of power over that system. And so those conditions were definitely part of why we began the school and all of these schools kind of, you know, came up is that so the centralized part of it also is that there's only a single board of education in Hawaii. So on average in states throughout the U.S., there are over 200 boards of education in each state. And so governance of schooling is, you know, closer to the community level. So you have a case in Hawaii where you have small schools in very rural areas and huge schools on different islands with very different kinds of needs, all governed by the same board. And so this is in many ways antithetical to an indigenous perspective on knowledge, that, you know, knowledge is place-based, it's community-based, that we need to attend to where we are located. And so both in terms of the organization in Hawaii, as well as a larger trend of standardizing education in the U.S., you know, there was just no room for indigenous knowledge. And that obviously has a huge impact on indigenous students. And so, like is the case in many indigenous communities, Native Hawaiian students have, you know, the highest dropout rates or pushout rates, you know, highest levels of reporting being under the influence of alcohol or drugs in school, getting in fights, all of these kinds of negative indicators, right? And so it's part of a move to, rather than seeing just the deficits, you know, what are the strengths of our communities, our cultures, our histories? And if we immerse our students in those strengths, you know, then the whole theory was that they would do better, they would be excited to be in school, and would be more successful. And so that's kind of where the, you know, the thrust of these different schools came from.
So when you decided to go through with this, to create the school, you had to take it to the Hawaiian State Board of Education to, I guess, get certified. And I found that a really, gripping passage in the introduction to your book, when you have to go into what's a rather hostile environment of administrators, people on the Board of Education who don't necessarily share your priorities. You talk about how that presentation was an exercise in delicate rhetorical maneuvering. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about that day and how you ultimately fared. I mean, how that went and the aftermath.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the major sort of central tensions that I try to bring up in the book is, what does it mean to do Indigenous cultural revitalization work, community revitalization work, within the structures of settler state institutions? And, you know, we need to do this work. This is for education. This is where our kids are. But at the same time, there are these major limiting factors, not the least of which is that the majority of people who are in positions of power in those institutions are not Indigenous. And more importantly, don't necessarily see the value of Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous communities. And so, you know, that's a battle I think that many people are familiar with, as far as this ongoing narrative that, you know, the knowledges that come from our traditions, our peoples, Indigenous peoples all over the world, is seen as, you know, sort of anachronistic, irrelevant to the present, right? That we are always being written about or talked about as, you know, sort of the past. And so part of what we were trying to do, I think, in that day when we went before the Board of Education to argue for this, was to, you know, be able to present an argument for why this kind of education is necessary, in a way that was critical of the mainstream school system. But yet, you know, they're the ones who have power over that system. And so you want to be critical enough so that they can see a need for what you're trying to do without offending them so much that they just cut you off.
You talk about one of the central projects as rearticulating schooling, or to rearticulate schooling. What do you mm-hmm. mean by that?
Yeah. So in this case, I'm talking about articulation, a meaning of articulation that comes from articulation theory that's elaborated in various cultural studies literature, where it's talking about connection and disconnecting and reconnecting, the articulating. It comes from the language of articulating the cars, train cars. And so when you hook them together, you know, you're articulating and then unhook and rehook somewhere else. And so what I'm talking about there is basically, you know, disconnecting or at least disrupting the political project of mainstream public schooling, which has been to erase Indigenous presence or marginalize it at the very least, or make it irrelevant, you know, and to rearticulate schooling as an institution, as a practice, in projects of Indigenous self-determination and survivance and revitalization. So it's really a sort of project of showing the value of Indigenous knowledge and cultural practice, both for those larger systems and people in power in those systems, but also for our own people. You know, we often internalize those messages that, you know, what are the traditions that come down from our elders may not be relevant to today. And so there's also the need to combat those kinds of self-defeating and internalized messages within our own communities.
It seems like one of the sort of answers that you propose, or at least one of the broader terms you put them under, is this idea of sovereign pedagogies, which is another term that you introduce, or at least I haven't seen it before. And I'm wondering if you can sort of introduce that concept as well, sovereign pedagogies.
Yeah. So the idea and the concept and the practice of sovereignty has been so important for many Indigenous nations because our autonomy and independence has been suppressed, you know, and so, that idea of having authority over our own affairs, our lands, over what we get to teach our children, has been an important motivating idea for so many aspects of Indigenous movement, social movements. And so I was, you know, taking that idea and applying it again to education and to knowledge building, that it's both on the collective and individual level, that when an individual student or a collective community has the sense that I have some autonomy over what it is that I'm learning, you know, it's self-directed, then people are more engaged. And I think that's something that you find in a lot of educational literature, you know, sort of just in general, that when a learner has control, and real ownership over what it is that they're learning, they do better. The learning is deeper. But again, it's also signaling that education and schooling in particular today is a national prerogative, you know, that it's a part of the cultural work that is done to maintain a sense of nationhood, whether that's for a settler nation like the United States, or whether it's nations for whom, you know, our independence and autonomy is not currently recognized. It's an important aspect of maintaining our sense of who we are. And sovereignty also has this really, what's the word I'm looking for? It's got baggage. You know, sovereignty, the term has baggage because it comes out of a Western political tradition of what it means to be a collective group of people who is governing, who is self-governing, and what that means. And, you know, it's very much tied to the nation state in a Western form. And so I was consciously using that because, you know, to do Indigenous education in a school system is to operate within certain kind of limitations of what it, you know, of what education looks like.
There's one other concept I'm hoping you can introduce a bit or talk about a little bit, and that's land-based literacies. And I think a lot of people wouldn't even be necessarily familiar with the pluralization of literacy. I mean, they think of literacy as pretty bounded to the ability to read and write in the written word. You not only say there are multiple forms of literacy, but one of the ones that's central to this pedagogical practice of the school is land-based. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think there are, you know, popping up in various kinds of fields and places, ways of pluralizing the term literacy to understand that what gets counted as language or as communication is always political in some way, that what counts as you know, proper kind of language is invested in maintaining or disrupting certain kinds of relations of power. So anyway, different sorts of literacies, media literacies, for example, you know, people talk about what it means to become fluent in how to read and look at different kinds of media other than print. So film and how to engage critically. One of the things that I was trying to really get at by using that term is that within mainstream education in the U.S., today, a very particular kind of standardized literacy is put forward as the only sort of literacy, you know, reading and writing in standard English from a certain kind of cultural perspective. And so the other part of that is that, again, as I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, the standardization of knowledge that has in particular been heightened by the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 and in Hawaii, the implementation of different kinds of content and performance standards in schooling has basically been based on this idea that you should be able to go to a classroom, whether it's in Iowa or California or Hawaii, and be able to learn the exact same thing in all of those places when you're, you know, at the fourth grade level or something. Every fourth grader across the board should be learning the same thing. And I definitely think there's value, you know, in having common things that we learn all together. But what I try to get at there is that, you know, really being able to pay attention to the land, the place where you're located, is essential to Indigenous knowledge. It's what's enabled our peoples to survive for hundreds of generations. And when we think about how our societies are going to be sustainable in the long run, unless we're paying attention to where we are, where the resources are, how they're being utilized, what our relationship is to them, we're not going to be able to sustain life. And I think this is, you know, what one of the great lessons and sort of brilliance of our ancestors was, this very close and intimate relationships with the places where we have grown out of.
So Halo Kuimana is a charter school, and as you acknowledge it, very rightly so, the charter school movement, at least as it's most commonly known or it's most publicly known, is linked with corporate-backed privatization schemes. I mean, it's one of those buzzwords that corporate reformers of education use to continue their plans. And you identify that form of charter school movements as a neo-colonial project. But Native Hawaiian community-based charter schools are, of course, anti-colonial in nature. How have you navigated that? How have you tried to avoid close association with that other breed of charter schools that's pushing privatization?
Yeah, good question. I don't think necessarily that charter school operators in Hawaii, in Native Hawaiian charter school operators, have always been really cognizant of trying to do that. I mean, I think it's been more a process of making alliances both among each other across different Hawaiian charter schools and with other Native communities doing education in different ways, not always in charter schools, right? Some are tribal-run public schools. So there hasn't necessarily been a conscious effort to distance Native Hawaiian charter schools from that more conservative element of the U.S. charter school movement. In fact, I think I was just working with a group of Hawaiian charter school administrators, teacher leaders this past semester, and there were several that were not even aware that, you know, this was a major part of the charter school movement on the U.S. continent because it's so different in Hawaii. And one of the reasons why I think it's been different in Hawaii is we had a very, from a charter school perspective, a moderate sort of a law that was in many ways because Hawaii has a strong legacy of labor organizing. And so, you know, the trend has always been for unions to really be cautious about charter schools. And so in Hawaii, the law that was passed limited charter schools to only 25 at first, only 25 schools. There was only a single authorizer, which was the Board of Education, where in other states, there are multiple authorizers. And also that you couldn't have a for-profit entity operating a charter school. And so that's really been the major problem, right, in other places, that you have for-profit entities operating schools and then oftentimes, you know, pushing models that would be cheaper as far as operating costs, but not necessarily heightening the educational value for students and communities. So we've been sort of, you know, unique in Hawaii in that respect. And that hasn't always been because of a conscious effort by Native Hawaiian charter school operators to create that distance, but more so because of the strong history of labor organizing in the islands, which has been multi-ethnic.
I do really, I like the idea of a sort of corporate school reformer picking up this book and really getting themselves into a big surprise when they read about it. I suspect that'll happen. And I really like, I like that
so.
That'll happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so. That they, you know, search for the term charter schools and see,
right,
you know, oh,
right.
Great. Yeah.
And go, look, this is wonderful. Look, it's,
yeah.
So charter schools, the sort of tension around charter schools was one of two significant dangers that you identified. The other are what you called safety zones. You write that these are state-enforced spaces for containing potentially threatening indigenous cultural difference by allowing just enough culture so it doesn't threaten or undermine settler-colonial relations of power. How have you seen this play out, and how have you how successful do you think you've been in navigating that particular danger?
Yeah, and you know, this isn't my idea. This is an idea that comes out of the work of Chanina Lomawaima and Teresa McCarty, and they talk about in their history of Indian education in the U.S. how over time U.S. policy has shifted between, you know, sometimes allowing, sometimes completely disallowing indigenous languages, and then sometimes allowing and actually funding. And so what they, you know, talk about is how different cultural practices are at sometimes seen as dangerous to the settler society, and other times seen as, you know, acceptable. And so what we're called upon to do is to think about in what ways different practices kind of move in and out of that kind of category. In Hawaii, you know, this is a really important idea for us because certain aspects of Hawaiian culture are heavily coveted by, you know, settler, state, or corporate power. So, for example, the ways in which the hula has been commodified and sold, and images of Hawaii and a certain kind of feminized Hawaiian culture. There's a really interesting article that educational scholar and theorist Julie Ka'omea, who works here at UH in the College of Ed, wrote, called A Curriculum of Aloha, where she looked at Hawaiian studies textbooks in the mainstream public system alongside tourist brochures, and by juxtaposing these two kinds of different printed materials, sees these incredible similarities between the ways that the lands and people of Hawaii are represented. And so that's something, you know, that we definitely have to be aware of and conscious of, that just being visible doesn't necessarily mean liberating. In fact, it can mean exactly the opposite at times. Some of the ways this has kind of played out in the school system and the school setting is, you know, so for example, it would be okay to have Hawaiian language as a second language, sort of a elective part of the curriculum, but to have it be the basis of the curriculum has been a real uphill battle for the schools, not just charter schools, but, you know, Hawaiian language immersion schools that preceded Hawaiian charter schools. For it to be the foundation, I think, is really where it becomes the problem. If it's just sort of a side dish, you know, sort of window dressing, it's not as problematic. But it's when it becomes the foundation that it becomes more highly suspect and regulated.
At HKM, are most classes taught in the Hawaiian language?
It's a secondary school, so most of the students are coming in from English-speaking schools, and so they all take Hawaiian language as part of their regular curriculum every year. So it's required that they take Hawaiian language every year for the duration. But the instruction is bilingual, and it'll depend upon the students and the teachers, you know, the extent to which they can do more. So, for example, I talk about in the book, Lo'i Kalo Restoration Project. So that's our wetland taro fields that were, you know, once a really important part of our agricultural technologies in Hawaii and have been being revitalized over the last several years. And so in those kinds of contexts, they'll also not only have sort of classroom language instruction, but contexts where students can be using the language and you know, learning the different terms. And I talk about in the book, for example, a period where they're only allowed to speak Hawaiian. So it's brought in, but, you know, it is a process of having to, for most students, introduce Hawaiian as a second language. English, for the majority of them, is their first language.
You actually, I'm reminded of the opening of the second chapter, when you talk about students who have come from other schools, and you open that chapter with a story about a video project, a senior video project that you worked on with the first graduating class of the school. And you talk about how the students and you went back to their old school, and the sort of very alienating, carceral built environment of that old school. You write that the school had been a place these students tolerated and survived. They saw themselves reflected in the security guards hired to keep them on campus. At the end of that vignette, you talk about how the school, that HKM, wanted to be a radical departure from the fences, the walls, the bell schedules. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about that, particularly that aspect of the built environment. I see it in New York City all the time. Schools are increasingly resembling prisons, factory warehouses. Sometimes they're genuinely indistinguishable. How have you tried to step away from that very oppressive built environment that was so alienating to these students?
Well, I think the first part of it is, you know, having smaller schools so that it can, you know, when you have a huge population. So the school that we visited, for example, you know, that thousands of kids go to that school. That they had come out of. And so keeping people sort of in order, you know, was really sort of an important part of the management of that particular school. So part of it is, you know, having a more, a smaller, more community-based family sort of level. Everybody knows each other at HKM. Everybody knows each other's families. You know, it's a school of just over 100 or so kids, 120. That was one part of it. But the other thing was, you know, really seeing our lands as not just classrooms, but as sources of learning, So when we started to design the curriculum, we were trying to look at ways to build courses around particular places and practices rather than, you know, disciplines and sort of silo knowledge in English, social studies, math, and realized that, you know, students actually make better connections when they're seeing how these various kinds of disciplines interact with each other and operate in terms of helping one understand and relate to places. And so there have been various places over the course of the school's 12-year now operation. And one of them is the lo'i that I write about, the taro fields in Manoa Valley. Another is actually not what we might consider a place per se, but, you know, from a Hawaiian perspective, the va'a or the canoe is itself a moku, an island. And so that's another chapter that we write about, or that I write about, you know, the ways that those places have been seen as sites of learning. So students will go out to those, you know, either once or twice a week. And that's helped, you know, give a sense that learning is not just about sitting passively in a classroom, a four-walled classroom, but it's really about taking it beyond and seeing our landscape itself as a teacher.
So that sort of vignette that I used to ask you this last question, it begins a chapter about No Child Left Behind, the massive educational reform bill that President George W. Bush signed in 2001. Mm-hmm. You call it a re-assimilating force. What obstacles did it erect or entrench when you were still in the early years of HKM?
Well, a number of things. The requirements for what's considered to be a highly qualified teacher, so, you know, HQT is a sort of buzzword status, and that teachers have to be not only certified to teach in the level that they're teaching, so like secondary level, but within the particular discipline that they're teaching. And so this made it really difficult to have an interdisciplinary curriculum, because if you have students in multiple age groups, let's say you have a 9th and 10th grade class, and they're doing a project-based sort of course that combines both science and social studies, with traditional knowledge about va'a, with a canoe, then you have to have, you know, teachers who are certified in those discrete subjects. And for our, you know, cultural practitioners who are masters of knowledge themselves, you know, this basically excludes them altogether from having a paid position as a teacher. So in this particular case that I write about with the va'a, with the canoe, you know, we had a teacher who was trained and sanctioned to teach by master navigators in both Hawaii and Satawal. So where the revitalization of Hawaiian voyaging knowledge came from was really making this connection with a master navigator from Satawal, Micronesian, named Papa Mau Pi'ailug. And so she studied under, you know, two different navigators, was sanctioned by them to teach, also had her own advanced degrees from a Western institution in counseling and guidance. But because she wasn't specifically certified to teach science, you know, she couldn't be a paid teacher. And so, you know, that was a real, both a reassimilation in terms of who can staff, but also in the way knowledge is constructed, how we think about it, you know, that, again, it's pushing knowledge back into these silos that, you know, someone who studies science isn't necessarily someone who also is capable of teaching across disciplines. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example.
Sure.
you know, the other obvious one is the standardized testing that students go through and what that's meant as far as determining adequate yearly progress or AYP under No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, when there are high stakes tests, and I don't think anyone at HKM and other Hawaiian charter schools have ever argued that it's not important for students to learn how to do math in the Western sense or to be able to read and write English and perform well on standardized tests. But when those are the tests that become the measuring point for whether a school is considered successful or not, then of course, as has been the case for every other school, you know, other things have to fall by the wayside. Other things have to be prioritized, or those things have to be prioritized over things like math and music, or being on the canoe.
Yeah. And there's funding that's tied to those tests, right?
I mean, directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and just existence. So not even, you know, not even funding or funding, and in addition, just being able to continue operating. And so Halau Kumana did go through a process of restructuring, which I talk about in the book, and, you know, it was able to get out of restructuring status, but not without costs to the way that the curriculum was organized
mm-hmm.
and staffed.
So you have a whole chapter, or at least a good part of a chapter, about some of the political activism that Halau Kumana students were involved in, or are still involved in. I thought that was really great. I mean, I remember some of my most deeply educational experiences in high school were around protests against the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and you know, mm-hmm. those weren't necessarily sanctioned by the school, but they were probably much more educational than a lot of what I was getting in the school. But it sounds like HKM is a place where students don't feel like they need to shy away from being political. Even though, you know, in many other schools, you also make the point, of course, that all schools are inherently political. But mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you could, yeah, talk a bit about that dimension of the student's life and what some movements that these students have been involved with.
Yeah. So like you said, I, you know, make the argument that all schooling is political, whether people are aware of that or not, that, it, you know, schooling is about either reproducing or challenging different relations of power. And one of the things that I also try to talk about in the book is that when you're doing Indigenous revitalization work within settler state structures, you have to be consciously rebuilding the Indigenous structures that provide health and life and well-being. Otherwise, you'll just be limited and pigeonholed as a safety zone. You know, you won't be actually doing anything that's transformative. And it's essential to be transforming the current reality when Indigenous peoples are, you know, facing the kinds of violences and inequalities and conditions that we are. And so, you know, I talk about the voice as one of these kinds of structures that, you know, students cultivating their voice, being able to speak, to articulate their identities, their opinions, their political positions is really crucial to this whole process. And it's also been sort of a fact of life, you know, that for Indigenous people, for Native Hawaiians, for others in other contexts, just to survive and continue to be who we are often involves political struggle, right? Just being able to remain in place and keep, you know, eating the food that we have always eaten has often required huge political battles. So the students have been involved in a number of different kinds of actions over the years. You know, one obvious one that the schools would be involved in is fighting for equitable funding. So in the case of charter schools in Hawaii, the per pupil funding has always been inequitable. So it's been significantly less than the already poor funding for public schools. And so that's been one battle, you know, sort of keeping our school alive kind of thing. And that's never been something that students have been forced to do, but they're always, you know, exposed to that possibility. Have been taken to different kinds of rallies at the state capitol to meet legislators, to watch hearings, to testify if they wanted to perform at the legislature. The other major sort of political issues that I talk about is the relationship between Kanaka Native Hawaiians and Haloa, or the Taro, the Kalo, who is our elder sibling and historically the staple food for our people. And so this has particularly over the last several years been around efforts by others to patent and or genetically engineer Hawaiian taro. And so students, because they have, as part of the curriculum, been really involved in revitalizing taro agriculture, you know, it's made sense to be part of these discussions. And so there's one moment in the book where there's a student who remembers, she's recalling this event where they went to the University of Hawaii's Central Administration Building, Bachman Hall, and it was over this issue of whether scientists at the University of Hawaii could patent three varieties of Hawaiian taro. And she talks about how, you know, we came there just to talk to you, just to express, you know, what our feelings are, what we've learned, and she sees them being shut out, you know, with a security guard at the door. None of the people in power will even come and talk to them. And that was a powerful moment for her to see, like, we just came here to talk to you and you completely shut us out. So she also talks about how, you know, it was through those kinds of experiences that she learned to find her own voice, you know, that she had been really hesitant about speaking up or not feeling like her voice was worthy to be heard or she had anything valuable to say. But from those kinds of experiences, you know, really, really getting a sense of the importance and the power of her own voice.
The beautiful part of being part of a social movement, I think.
Yeah.
It really is. So I've been speaking with Noelane Goodyear Kaupua, author of The Seeds We Planted, Portraits of a Native Hawaiian Charter School. Noelana, before I let you go, I want to ask, what do you think other communities can take from this, and what impact do you hope the book will have particularly?
Well, I hope that we can continue to make connections across different Indigenous communities. I think one of the things that we've experienced with Halau Kumana is the way that we learn and are inspired from exchange with Indigenous peoples in various places. And so I hope that that can really continue so that, you know, because many of us are numerical minorities in our own locations, the more kind of solidarity we can build, the more power we have. I hope it will also really make an impact on people who work in mainstream educational systems to see that these issues are ones that need to be taken on by everyone. They're not just, you know, just for Indigenous communities. There's huge value in Indigenous language revitalization, Indigenous agricultural revitalization, for the sustainability of all people in our places. And so I hope that the book will also, you know, generate even more movement around transforming education.
Well, congratulations. It's a really great achievement to have this book
out.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
I hope it's widely read. Thank you again for joining me.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
That was Noelani Goodyear Ka'upoa, author of The Seeds We Planted, Portraits of a Native Hawaiian Charter School, from the University of Minnesota Press. This is New Books in Native American Studies. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past interviews free of charge, or on iTunes, where you can download and subscribe to the podcast. We're also on Facebook. You can leave comments, questions, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.